Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Benal of BenalofAmerica.com with the season finale of Benal of America Audio Season 1. That's right, folks. After 9 months, 22 guests, and 32 episodes, Benal of America Audio Season 1 has reached its climax. We are finishing up here with a massive guest, a super A-list name, an ultra-rare interview with the notorious UK UFO hacker Gary McKinnon. This man's facing some serious jail time. He's done some amazingly daring things. He's been thrust into the center of a worldwide story. And we're going to get his perspective on all that here this week on Benal of America Audio for the Season 1 season finale. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Gary McKinnon and his story, let me bring you up to speed before we kick off the interview. He is a former computer systems administrator who was accused of hacking into 97 United States military and NASA computers in 2001 and 2002. The computer networks he is accused of hacking into include networks owned by NASA, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy, Department of Defense, and the U.S. Air Force, and also one belonging to the Pentagon. The U.S. estimates claim the costs of tracking and correcting the problems he allegedly caused were around $700,000 U.S. McKinnon was originally tracked down and arrested under the Computer Misuse Act by the UK National High-Tech Crime Unit in 2002, and later that year was also indicted by the United States government. He remained at liberty, although subject to bail conditions, including a requirement to sign in at his local police station every evening and to remain at his home address at night. In addition, he was banned from using a computer with access to the internet. If he is extradited to the United States and charged, McKinnon faces up to 70 years in jail and has expressed fears that he could be sent to Guantanamo Bay. He has said that he will contest the extradition proceedings and believes that he should face a trial in the UK, principally as he argues that his crimes were committed there and not in the United States. You can find out more information on the latest developments in Gary's case at www.freegary.org.uk. So, that's the Gary McKinnon story. Now, let's hear it from the man himself. This interview was conducted on June 21st, 2006. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary McKinnon, on the Benal of America Audio Season 1, Season Finale. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Season Finale of Benal of America Audio. I want to welcome my special guest for this Season Finale. He made worldwide news. His story has become a major story in ufology, and it's been talked about all over the place. And he's facing numerous counts of computer hacking in search of UFO secrets. All the way from the UK, Gary McKinnon, welcome to Benal of America Audio.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Gary, why don't you talk about first your interest in ufology and how it brought you to hacking, and then eventually how that hacking led to your arrest and now the situation you're in right now. How's that sound?
Okay, yeah. I've heard quite a bit about UFOs. I was about 14. And, well, in fact, earlier than that, maybe around 11 or 12. And at the age of 14, I joined something called BUFOR, and that's the British UFO Research Association. And I had quite a strong interest back then, which was lost slightly as I grew older. So I found recently, actually, there's a huge, you know, a huge years and years worth of UFO literature that I'd never seen or heard of.
Yeah.
You know, photographs of the UFOs, books, etc. And, yeah, after a while, you get sick of, I mean, there's enough literature out there, even having not read all of it, to know that there definitely is a cover-up going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my sort of overpowering motive was to find something from the so-called secret government themselves that was an evidential file, basically evidential paperwork or copies thereof. And then rather than throw witness testimony at them or the kind of evidence they don't accept and keep calling weather balloons and smog gas and stuff,
yeah,
say, well, look, you know, here's some of your own official photography or documentation or whatever, so you know, you can't say against that.
Yeah. And then that led you to the hacking, obviously, and you thought that was the best case scenario or the best way to go about getting the information, or was it just that you had a skill in hacking, sort of, and then you were like, you were going to put it to use towards finding UFO secrets?
It was a bit of both, really. I mean, if I hadn't known a little bit about computer security already, it probably wouldn't have been an avenue that I'd take.
Yeah. And then the feds arrested you. How did that play out, and what specifically are the charges, and like, what's the worst case scenario? And obviously, I read an interview with you, and they offered a plea deal, but they wouldn't put it in writing. So talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about the how this all went down, where you were arrested.
the National High Tech Crime Unit over here, and men are part of something called SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Association, which is a new thing in this country. It's basically like a British version of FBI now. And when they first arrested me, they knew it was unauthorized access. They'd been watching me for 3 months. They said probably the worst case scenario would be either 6 months in jail or some community service. And then they went over to Washington, where they visited the Office of Naval Investigation, and I think also the Air Force Office of Special Investigation.
Okay.
And when they came back from those meetings, they their tone had really, really changed. They were much more serious.
Yeah.
And I found out since that I knew about A. Fozzie at the time, being Air Force Office of Special Investigations, being UFO related.
Yeah.
But I didn't know about the Office of Naval Intelligence, the ONI, but I've since found out that they too are the same, the same overlap of interest. And I think people that are sort of familiar with law enforcement in America are very surprised that the FBI weren't involved in a case like this. It was all sort of military law enforcement agencies, if you will.
Yeah, so it was like the guy from the UK went over to the US, and then he was probably gave a briefing or briefed or met with the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, so and it wasn't like no CIA involvement or FBI, like you said, right?
That's correct. Yeah.
So what's going on right now is obviously you admit that you hacked. What's your goal here? Are you trying to just not come to America to face this and would rather do the time in the UK, or do you want the charges dropped? Like what is your side looking for here?
I'd like to. I mean, I'd love for it to be dropped. It's been a sentence in itself. It's passed nearly 5 years now. But I'd definitely like the right just to be tried in my own country. I mean, we've got guys that are accused terrorists from Baghdad and Iraq, some of which have won the right to be tried over here in the UK just because they're under the auspices of British troops in Iraq. Now, some Iraqi accused terrorists can have the right to get a trial in Britain, then surely I should, you know. And also over here, it's sort of might be 6 months in jail.
Yeah.
The unauthorized access charges, because the damage charges are ridiculous. I found out that for it to be an extraditable offence, it has to be worth 1 year in prison. And for it to be a 1 year prison term for a computer offence, you have to have caused at least $5,000 worth of damage.
Yeah.
And every machine I was on, they said I've caused exactly $5,000 worth of damage on, so. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And I said to some, you know, why on earth are they so vehement? And why is it the first extradition case in the history of hacking as well? And this was an investigative journalist, Peter Warren, that went over there and interviewed some top brass. And they said, well, it's because of where he's been and what he might have seen. And I've also since found out, having met a lot of people in the UFO community since, that a lot of the places I was in at the time, I didn't realize how sensitive they were, like China Lake. Fort, is it Huachuca or Huachuca or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Which now, you know, apparently, you know, strong UFO links and bank engineering, ET technology.
And over the course of the arrest and the subsequent prosecution, at what point did you tell them that you were doing all this for UFO secrets, and what was their reaction to what you said, that you were going after UFO secrets?
Well, all the way down the line, I maintained that. I mean, if we were able to see my hard drive, which I think is still with the ONI, which is actually a legal possession of case-related material, it's full of UFO stuff and other stuff as well, as well as all the trails of the unauthorized access. And I've made full and frank admissions all the way down the line to the unauthorized access, and they were monitoring me for 3 months. So the damage thing is the real. The accusations of damage is what's damaging me. You know, it's patently ridiculous, and. I'd like the right to be tried in my own country, so the evidence has to be supplied, because I know there is no evidence of damage.
Yeah, but like when you said to the people who were trying to prosecute you, when you were like, listen, I'm just going for UFO secrets. I'm not interested in hurting you guys or whatever. What did they laugh you off, or did they not believe you, or like what was their reaction to that?
Yeah, the National High Tech Crime Unit, who are quite a friendly bunch of guys in the end, was kind of joking about little green men, etc.
Yeah.
But they did have, as I said, the first interview before they went to Washington was very different from the second. And in the second interview, they actually asked me if I was a member of any terrorist organizations.
Oh,
like Al-Qaeda or whatever, which is just, you know, I laughed when I was asked that.
Yeah. And
you thank God I wasn't.
I know. And did do you have any idea what exactly went down, other than the briefing that between the British officials and the ONI and the AFOSI? Like, do you have any idea what was going on in that meeting and what the details of that were that made them change their stance so fast?
Well, no, but I think given the sequence of events, the initial arrest by the National High Tech Crime Unit was March 2002.
Yeah.
And then the long police interview with me, not the first police cell interview, the second one, was probably around May or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the visit to Washington was, I think, June or July.
Yeah.
And then the second interview, maybe shortly after that, maybe July or August. And then November, then the Bush administration say they intend to present an application to extradite me.
Okay. What's your family think about what's happened to you throughout this whole thing? Obviously, they're on your side, I assume. But what are they worried about it? Are you worried about going to jail? And what do you think of all this?
Yeah, they're very worried about it. Definitely, it's very upsetting to think of. I'm very worried. Such a long sentence. It's just ridiculous. And I'm very worried about being sort of spirited away and coming under this military order number one thing, which is quite a serious threat.
Yeah.
Which basically means a military tribunal, you know.
Yeah, is that what will happen to you if you are extradited to the U.S., that you won't get a straight-up U.S. trial, that it'll be like a military trial?
I'm advised there's a strong likelihood of that, yeah.
Okay, and then you'd end up, if they found you guilty and everything, which is, if it's a military tribunal, it sounds like it's pretty one-sided in and of itself. Would you be able to bring your UK lawyer with you, or would you get a whole new US lawyer?
I think it'd be a new American lawyer, yeah.
Now, it's kind of ironic because there's a very famous UFO hacker case that comes out of the UK, the Matthew Bevin case. I'm sure you're familiar with it then, yeah. And in that instance, the government dropped the charges because they couldn't supply the right evidence. Why is your case different? And, try to talk a little bit about the Matthew Bevin case, because I'm sure you're pretty familiar with it because you're kind of in the same shoes he was. Why is your case different from the Matthew Bevin case where they couldn't keep going with the charges?
Well, as you say, yeah, it's very similar in that we're both hunting for suppressed technology, UFO, anti-gravity stuff.
Yeah.
And but the difference is he was being done under the old extradition agreements, wherein you had to supply what they call a prima facie case. You have to have a solid body of evidence. Whereas I'm being prosecuted under the 2003 extradition treaty, in which the requesting country for the extradition, i.e. in this case America, doesn't have to supply any evidence. And it's actually, the UK government couldn't do that to an American citizen, thank God, because you're protected by the Constitution. And also this treaty, where you don't have to supply any evidence, hasn't been signed by the Senate yet, hasn't been ratified. So it's currently a one-ended treaty.
Yeah.
So it's a really blurry area of international law as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I sort of noticed when I was doing the research for this interview was that that hacking, and you can probably speak to this pretty well, hacking is kind of like an addiction in a sense that you really just got to keep doing it. You're not, I don't know, do you know what I mean? Is there sort of an addictive quality to hacking? I don't want to sound like a liberal too much, but at the same time, I think there is some merit to that argument that there's an addictive quality to the hacking.
Yeah, definitely. I think, especially with men, I think we're slightly more like that than women. I think you can get very obsessional about something. And especially, I consider myself in a way to be on a kind of moral crusade looking for this free energy technology.
Yeah.
So I think, and also, you know, there were things going on in my personal life as well. So it was kind of, mixed in with the addiction and thinking that you're morally correct, even though you know you're not meant to gain unauthorized access.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most people in America believe that the governments know about the UFO problem, they know the origins and their motives. And if we do have this free energy technology. It's something that the world deserves to have, and surely we can phase it in. We don't have to knock down all the oil companies straight away. It can be slowly phased in. I'm sure we could find a, you know, a genuine, sane economic effort and solution.
Yeah, and the free energy, sort of was coupled with the search for UFO information. You sort of like tie those two together, because obviously that's how what's powering the UFOs, you presume, right?
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah.
And what's been the reaction to in the hacking community to your story? I mean, I know you you can't really use the internet much at all, or I think you're probably not allowed to use it in any way now, but so you probably don't know what the hacking community is saying, but you might have heard, or when it first went down, maybe you did. What's been their reaction to this case?
I think a lot of them are very angry at the fact that it could end up changing from 6 months doing community service into 60 years in prison.
Yeah.
And especially the fact that it's got a lot of British hackers angry just because of the legal aspects of it, you know, no evidence required yet. The treaty's a one-end treaty. But yeah, as you say, I mean, I've got limited access to the internet. I'm allowed to access the internet if I get the IP address of the employer or the organization or whatever, and then provide that to the court, but it's only one IP address.
Yeah. While you're doing all this hacking to look for the UFO secrets, did you sort of like have this end game in mind? Like, you had to have known that possibly you were going to get caught, or like, where did you think this all was going to go? That you were going to get the information and then break this case wide open, or were you always sort of worried that one day they could come and take me for this?
Yeah, I mean, I was aware of the possibility of getting caught, but I must admit, I wasn't thinking of it very often.
Yeah.
And I suppose when I did, I mean, in my mind, unauthorized access, thinking that I'd be prosecuted in my own country if it ever came to, would only be a few months, so.
Yeah, it became bigger than you thought it would turn out to be, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I felt that, you know, my kind of mission, as it were, was more important, and it was getting a bit interesting, and I was finding the odd thing, so.
Yeah. And how long were you hacking, roughly? I think I have here in my notes 7 years of hacking. Was that pretty much roughly the time frame, amount of time that you were looking?
No, 2000, 2001.
What's that?
2000, 2001, 2 years.
Just 1 year?
2 years.
Oh, you were only hacking for 2 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you had started in, like, the mid-90s and hacked all the way up to 2002.
Oh, no, I started my computer contracting mid-90s and learning about computer security, yeah.
Oh, okay, but you only really began the search around 2001, you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, so that explains a lot of maybe why you didn't really come up with anything tangible out of the whole thing. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. There seems to be a little bit of frustration within the UFO community, which is always the case, really, but with this story in general, because you haven't really produced any, like, tangible, like you said, you were searching for the documents and searching for the thing you could throw in the government space, but you didn't quite get it. Speak to that a little bit. Why didn't you get anything that we could use here to throw at the government?
Because I'm not here to produce evidence for what I saw. I'm here because I got caught. I mean, you know, I didn't envision this at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I did see, for me the most, although it's still circumstantial, there was the Don Hare, the NASA photographic expert, who I saw in the Disclosure Project press conference video, that she was working in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center and had secret above clearance. And a colleague showed what were basically photographs of flying saucers, and basically implying that his job was to airbrush them out.
Yeah.
And having already done this blank password scanning method, must bear that in mind as well. It wasn't, you know, I'm not some huge mastermind hacker, it was more because the security was very, very lax rather than I was very, very clever.
Yeah.
She said something like, oh, isn't that just a blob in the emulsion? You know, and he was like, well, no, if you look very closely, there's actually a shadow beneath the flying saucer, and apparently showed her quite a few images of these. And bearing in mind, this is on the Disclosure Project video, there was, you know, 400 witness testimonies of the nearly 2 hours worth of footage for about 20 or so of those witnesses. They're all incredibly credible. I mean, you know, it's like radar operators, civilian air traffic controllers, people responsible for launching nuclear missiles. So to me, this story from this woman and the company she was in had to be something to go for. So using the same blank password scanning method, I got into Johnson Space Center, used some network commands to strip out the machines that were possibly in Building 8, and got the blank password subset of those machines. And lo and behold, there were the folders, something like raw and processed or filtered and unfiltered.
Yeah. And why didn't you print out any of these pictures or save them to a disk or put them away as like a safekeeping so you'd be okay in the long run?
Yeah, I'm on a 56K dial-up at the time, so you're talking maybe 4.5 or 5 minutes for 1 megabyte. And these pictures were like 200, 230, 300 megabytes in size.
Oh, man.
And, so it would have taken a while, and even if I used like a download resumer, you know what might have happened and how long could I possibly maintain that connection for if this is a secret lab for airbrushing out UFO images, you know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to grab it straight away, and I think the time zone was wrong as well. I think people were still working in the office.
Yeah.
So I quit the desktop. You have to imagine if you picture yourself there, it was a product called Remotely Anywhere. And it gives you graphical remote control of the desktop, just as if you're sitting on the chair by the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And you can turn that down to very low resolution, I think maybe 640 by 480, maybe down to monochrome or 4-bit color. And then I navigate to the folder on the desktop and double-click one of these images at random. And it's in some kind of sort of NASA proprietary format, like JPEG or a GIF or anything.
Yeah.
And it has got an application associated with it. It launches, it opens the window, and the picture starts coming down the screen. It is still very, very slow. But with all those methods in place, that's technically faster than actually downloading it.
Yeah, yeah. And
also you get to see it while it's happening rather than having a file coming down and seeing nothing of it as the transfer is live.
Yeah, exactly. And how many of these pictures would you say you saw?
When I was in a console in the initial connection, and I did a DIR command, you know, to get a directory listing.
Yeah.
And it was going on and on and on for like 10, 15, 20 seconds. And I can't remember how many were in the folder when I quit the desktop, but hundreds. And that was just one folder, you know, there were lots of different folders.
Yeah. And did you get any names of these pictures or anything? Were they numbered? Were they titled? How were they categorized?
I can't remember any numbering or anything on the pictures.
Yeah, so was it anything out of the ordinary, like they were named after Greek gods, or they were like numerically listed, or they had maybe like a picture reference number where you were like, I recognize that picture. Did you recognize any pictures that you saw maybe as anything famous like that or anything like that?
No, I only got a chance to download not even the whole of this first picture that I ran that I double-clicked on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you only really saw the one picture that you were sort of half downloading and then...
Yeah, and probably only about three quarters of that. And that's when this guy, well, I assume it was a guy, you know, the mouse moves across the screen and right-clicks your LAN icon and GD disconnects, and that was me out of Johnson.
Yeah.
And out of NASA, in fact.
So is the situation like where they're at Johnson Space Center on some random computer is like what you see on your computer?
Yeah, only it's not a random computer. It's just,
someone's computer.
Well, yeah, there's a specific subset in Building 8 pointed to by someone else who said they worked there, so it was corroboration.
Yeah. And then throughout while you were doing this, do you know if there are other Gary McKinnons and Matthew Bevins out there? Are there other UFO computer hackers? Like, is there any sort of situation where you knew of other people or people tipped you off to where to go or... Like, I don't want you to tell me anybody, obviously, because I don't want to get wrapped up in this. But
considering,
is it like is it a community at all, or is it sort of where you on your own here?
I did see documents on the net that implied there was some kind of community, and they had particular locations listed.
Okay.
Yeah. But while I was on there, as you probably read, there were loads of other connections all the time.
Yeah.
And I can only assume, you know, because of the blank password scanning and also it's administrator-level passwords, I'm not surprised there's lots of people on there. But perhaps because it's such an obvious entry method, maybe lots of them are just being nosy or looking for UFO information. Or, I mean, otherwise, you know, if it was some kind of terrorist organization or a foreign government, they'd be, I don't know, doing a lot more than snooping around.
Exactly, yeah.
But there wasn't a situation where, like, you had people who were emailing you, like, hey, Gary, check this out. I found this at this place.
No.
Like that. All right. Let me talk to you a little bit about the non-terrestrial officers aspect of your story. I wanted to ask you first, before we get into that, can you come up with any keywords or terms or ship names that came up that you think would be worthy of future investigation or just for the record sort of thing? Because I don't know if you've heard about it here in America, but we have some kind of story going out that's about Project Serpo, and it's a sort of situation where if we had an interview with somebody from like 10 years earlier and they were like, there's a thing called Project Serpo, and then you know, it came up later, we could be like, oh, wait a minute, there is something. So is there anything that stuck out in your mind that you say you saw a list of ship names? Anything specifically about the names, anything about what the names were, if you can remember, or any sort of keyword or term that might be helpful for future reference, like Freedom of Information Act or future research?
No, not at all. Also on that same night, as well as the ship names of the personnel list, the non-terrestrial office things, the fleet transfers, the material transfers, there's all sorts of strange and wonderful materials that were getting transferred. I don't remember a thing about the names.
You don't remember anything?
Nope.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you saw with regards to the non-terrestrial officers, the list of ship names, just what you saw, what you can remember about that, and was what part of the U.S. government were you looking into at this point? Was it the Navy?
I think it was the Navy, and I'm sure there were names and there's definitely ranks, but there was no designation to say, you know, that it was Navy personnel or Army personnel or Air Force personnel.
Yeah.
So there's no sort of emplacement within the military, just a rank and a name.
And it said list of, where did it say list of non-terrestrial officers is at the top of this list?
It was, an Excel spreadsheet, and it's like, all the columns stretched to make a heading bar.
Okay, and how did you, do you remember how you even came upon the list in the first place? What's the path that led you to that?
I can imagine normally when I had control over enough machines, I would run a program called Land Search, and that would search for all documents of certain types over the network and give you a list on screen, and you'd just double click on interesting ones and read them.
Okay. And now I think I heard in an interview that you did do some searches sort of for words like UFO and ET and that sort of thing. What is that correct?
Yeah, but I mean, obviously those particular keywords never worked.
Yeah. Okay, and like you said, you hacked into NASA. How extensive was the hacking into NASA, just to look for those pictures, or were you looking at other stuff too? And how long would you say you were in focused on NASA?
I mean, the pictures I didn't even expect to find. I thought, I've read about this in the book and stuff. And, maybe she is telling the truth. Maybe lots of them are credible, but you might get the one. You get disinformation lists in these groups as well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking for her to be so specific, maybe she is a disinformation list. So, that was a huge surprise. And obviously getting caught after finding them, I just couldn't gain re-entry then. But, up to that point, maybe good 2 or 3 months.
Okay. And like you said, once you got nailed that first time, you found the pictures and you couldn't get back after that, huh?
Yeah, and that was very quick at realizing the weakness and then blocking the hole.
Okay. Why don't you tell me a little bit, you sort of touched on it earlier, DARPA. You went after that and you were looking into DARPA. What you mentioned some kind of really spooky sounding training video that spooked me out when I read about it. But why don't you talk a little bit about what you were doing in DARPA and what you were looking for and what you found?
Well, I heard there was a secret robotics project going on there, and found that there was. It's the same blank password scanning mechanism. Bear in mind, these are private networks, and they're not, publicly advertised, they're not websites. So it's maybe not surprising that security is lax on some of them. I found software for autonomous robot control. The tiny little bomb-diffusing robots around. And I actually later read, I think it was the 2002 DARPA strategic plan, And most of this, although I didn't know at the time, was actually public knowledge. They're making machines to go into urban combat, basically.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, just kind of fun, like, God, they're not making... But I think the ultimate plan is actually to have almost, you know, Star Wars Walker-like machines, so you don't actually have to send people into war, which is kind of frightening.
Exactly. That is spooky. Like I said, can you talk a little bit about the training video that you saw that had words flashing up on the screen, and it might have been for, like, a Special Forces training video. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah, I think it must have been Special Forces. There was like a model village, I guess, made of like a dusty brick. And, brutality, domination, you know, breaking and entering, bashing into houses, you know, bashing down doors, doing a sort of double entry, corner sweep, blah, blah, blah. But I suppose, you know, brutality and domination are kind of how you want to get guys feeling when they're risking their lives.
Yeah, yeah. And did it say what branch of the Special Forces it was the video for, or was it just like...
No.
You don't recall that at all?
No.